The following talk is freely offered. If you'd like to learn more about the Sydney Zen Centre or to make a donation, please visit our website at szc.org.au.
Wu Men Quan, Case 10. Ching Shui, Solitary and Destitute. A monk said to Cao Shan, "I am Ching Shui, solitary and destitute. Please give me alms." Cao Shan said, "Venerable Shui." Ching Shui said, "Yes, sir." "You have already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and still you say that you have not moistened your lips." Woman's verse. With the poverty of Fan Tan and the spirit of Xiang Yu, though he can hardly sustain himself, he dares to compete with the other for wealth. Please sit comfortably, if you are not already comfortable. So once again, we are back in the Tang period in China, where our Zen tradition found its true voice, its creative and profound expression, which continues to inform and enlighten us. This is a story from one of the great koan collections. Its protagonists are Cao Shan, who is honored as one of the co-founders of the Soto school, along with Dong Shan. And the other person is Ching Shui, a mature student, possibly well known as he is named here. He comes in with a very strong presentation. "I am Ching Shui, solitary and destitute. Please give me alms." Strong and a little ambiguous. Solitary and destitute define radical poverty. How is Ching Shui poor? Is this a challenge to the teacher or a plea? Or a bit of both? Is he expressing need? True spiritual poverty is fully inhabiting the essential nature that is no nature. It is having thoroughly cleaned out the house of the mind and thrown out all the junk, and relieved of all those belongings, I, me, mine. There is nothing to worry about or defend, just the joy of the universe. I'm reminded of the wonderful poem by 8th century Yongjia, the Shodoka, or Song of Realizing the Way, which we read at Session. "I have entered the deep mountains to silence and beauty. In a profound valley beneath high cliffs, I sit under the old pine trees. Zazen in my rustic cottage is peaceful, lonely, and truly comfortable. High in the Himalayas, only feni grass grows. Here cows produce pure and delicious milk, and this food I continually enjoy." Zazen in the old house that used to be a corner shop that sits under a major flight path is peaceful, lonely, and truly comfortable. I saw an ad the other day for cheese, extolling the salty grass of windswept King Island, where, I quote, Cows are healthy and happy, and their milk is superb. Indeed, we must be poor in order to be able to receive, as the following anecdote illustrates. Ryo Khan lived the simplest kind of life in a hut at the foot of a mountain. One evening, a thief visited the hut, only to discover there was nothing to steal. Ryo Khan returned and caught him. "You may have come a long way to visit me," he told the prowler, "and you should not return empty-handed. Please take my clothes as a gift." The thief was bewildered, but he took the clothes and slunk away. Ryo Khan sat naked watching the moon. "Poor fellow," he mused. "I wish I could give him this beautiful moon." In this practice, self-emptying is prerequisite to any movement and insight. "Greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly," we chant. "I vow to abandon them." Again and again, letting thoughts and desires self-liberate, as the Dzogchen people say, thus making room for things to transform, for Dharma gates to open. Is Ching Shui presenting his realization of empty self nature and asking his teacher to meet him there? Or is his poverty unredeemed emptiness, a state of stuckness, or perhaps the black dog? Is he looking for a way out? If he were truly at ease here in utter poverty, why would he ask for anything else? Have you heard this riddle? Rich people want it. Poor people have it. It is greater than God, but worse than the devil. If you eat it, you'll die. What is it? That's really a riddle. Personally, I can certainly identify with Ching Shui as a sincere supplicant, caught in some kind of poverty mentality, or stranded in a spiritual desert of despair, seeking nourishment. Eitkan Roshi, our old teacher, saw this as a promising condition. At those times when nothing is quite clear, when meaning does not differentiate, when everything seems flavorless, when we want to run away but there's nowhere to go, he cautions patience and perseverance. The drought will break. But in the meantime, it's a challenge. At such times of desolation, faith is essential. Fear is okay, as long as faith is out in front. Devotional practices have been helpful to me. It is said that if you invoke Guan Yin by calling her name, she will respond. In my experience, this is true. Mysteriously, things shift. I have also found it helpful to recall the words of a dear teacher or friend. And it's often Robert Aitken, who said, "Everything is okay from the beginning." We are sincere supplicants all, obviously, to have made this level of commitment. Why are we here? What are we looking for? To know the Dharma, I might presume to answer. That is, to see how things truly are. Where is the truth which will set us free? The Mahayana is the way out of a lonely place, says my old teacher. The great vehicle. The big picture. And here the teacher Cao Shan comes back with the big picture. Venerable Shui.
Yes, sir.
You have already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and still you say you have not moistened your lips. Shibayama Roshi paraphrases Cao Shan's statement. What is lacking in you? The teacher turns tables on Qing Shui's presentation of poverty. Is this our fundamental misapprehension, that something is lacking in us? David Loy, a Buddhist philosopher, writer, and social theorist, who was a student of Robert Aitken and then Yamada Roshi, has an interesting take on dukkha, often translated as suffering, but more accurately, dissatisfaction. And he formulates it as a lack perception. I think it was in July, Larry Agresti posted something on the Sydney Zen Center list from a piece by David Loy, which was very interesting. He postulates that we intuit the impermanence and fundamental insubstantiality of our constructed self, but we misunderstand this as something missing in me. A feeling that something is wrong with me persists. We then set out to fix this situation by finding something, money, prestige, spiritual attainment, to fill up the perceived empty space, an endless, futile undertaking. And this next is his big thinking about how this has come about, which I'm sure is open to debate, but it's an interesting theory. He suggests that this sense of lack, is particularly acute in the West. And I am reminded of the Dalai Lama's intense puzzlement at finding that all Western Buddhist teachers suffered from feelings of inadequacy and low self-esteem. Loy traces it back to the Papal Reformation of the 12th century, when, he writes, our collective religious solution to lack first began to shift from an otherworldly to a thisworldly dimension, an approach which no longer looked up to the heavens, but forward to what could appear on earth in the future. The shift was gradual, of course. In the beginning, the emphasis was on creating the spiritual and social conditions which could hasten the return of Christ and the new millennium that he would inaugurate. Eventually, we became more confident about our ability to reshape society and the material conditions of our existence. This implied new understandings of temporality, rationality, and technology itself. Understandings now commonplace and therefore oblivious to the spiritual motivations that formed them. Our new preoccupation with progress involved redefining time, in effect as a schema for the expiation of guilt, which in my Buddhist terms becomes time originates from our sense of lack and our attempts to resolve that lack. Loy contrasts this contemporary notion of time with that of traditional societies and the pre-modern West, where time and what happens in time are not distinguished. History and cosmology are not separated. He quotes Eric Auerbach on the Middle Ages when the here and now is not a mere link in an earthly chain of events. It is simultaneously something which has always been and will be fulfilled in the future. And strictly in the eyes of God, it is something eternal. Medieval time was God's time. And for me, this brings to mind Dogen's existence time, or being time, expounded in his wonderful essay, Uji. It's not the same. There is no theological affinity, of course. Nor did Dogen affirm eternity. But still, I think it's cognate with God's time. So this is what Dogen has to say about existence time. Since a single moment has no substance of its own, it becomes interchangeable with the great eons. Because the great eons have no substance, they also embrace the single moment. Since time is inseparable from events, if one moment becomes non-obstructive, all dharmas will automatically become harmoniously merged. This is why all things and events in the three times vividly appear within one moment. And standing on the peak of a high mountain is existence time. Diving to the bottom of the deep ocean is existence time. A deity with three heads and eight arms is existence time. A Buddha with a magnificent body is existence time. A pillar and a lantern are existence time. You and friends in the neighborhood are existence time. The great earth and the empty sky are existence time. Our practices of mindfulness of breathing, one-pointed penetration, and spacious awareness comprise our great vehicle for reintegrating out there and in here, body and mind, for returning to live in time being, in God's time. God knows we need to. What do we discover when we let ourselves be fully present, when we can rest in difficulty, messiness, and uncertainty? That our perfection resides only here. We have never left the garden. Cao Shan engages Ching Shui to return him to the banquet table. Why are you crying poor? Why are you asking for a handout when you have been drinking Grange Hermitage all this while? Eiken Roshi points out there is a pun inherent in the Chinese text of this koan, whereby this noble wine comes from the house of no color and no form. Like the pure and delicious milk produced by cows who eat Feni grass or King Island grass, this wine is freely available to be enjoyed. It has an infinitely varied bouquet, layers of flavor, tastes of pain and beauty, and all the unique and rich facts of things as they are. Interestingly, there is another koan involving Cao Shan and drink. A monk asked Cao Shan, when one leaves off his mourning clothes, when one realizes a way out of suffering, how about that? Shan said, Cao Shan today has fulfilled filial piety. The monk said, how about after you have fulfilled filial piety? Shan said, Cao Shan loves to get drunk. Abandon yourself and find yourself, and then you can really abandon yourself. Christians renew themselves in the celebration of the Lord's Supper. Practice being present in God's time. And Christ, the great matter, to use our Buddhist terms, is in turn present in the bread and in the wine and in our very selves. Minnesotans renew themselves annually when the sweet corn season arrives. Armed with butter and salt, they partake in what Garrison Keillor nominates as one of life's four pleasures, the other three being a love of learning, the one you thought of when I first mentioned this, and the joy of following in the Lord's way. And finally, what of woman's verse? With the poverty of Fan Tan and the spirit of Xiang Yu, though he can hardly sustain himself, he dares to compete with the other for wealth. Fan Tan and Xiang Yu are archetypes for poverty and courage. Qing Shui has the presence to stand in no place and come forth with confidence wherever he finds himself. Finding myself at the end, is this the end? Or in any case, at a place where I have talked long enough, I'll say enjoy your zazen and this wonderful day.
This talk has been freely offered. If you'd like to learn more about Sydney Zen Centre activities or to make a donation, please visit www.szc.org.au. Thank you for listening.